This is KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59. Coming up next on the Heather McCoy Show, Heather welcomes the Washington editor of The Intercept, Ryan Grimm, to talk about the recent Politico profile of The Intercept and his forthcoming book on Alexandra Ocasio-Cortez.
Holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor Village Market's 8th birthday block party celebration on May 4th from noon to 3 at Village Market on North Trenton Street across from McCoy Park. Village Market is a nonprofit of Village Gardens working alongside North Portland community members to build food resiliency through youth leadership, community farming, and good food access. The Village Market birthday block party will include face painting and screen printing, a plant start sale hosted by our community gardeners, raffle prizes, food, plus a bake sale hosted by our youth leadership team, Foodworks. Again, that's Village Market's 8th birthday block party celebration on May 4th from noon to 3 at Village Market on North Trenton Street across from McCoy Park. Learn more at villagegardens.org or at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Happy belated May Day. You are listening to KBOO Portland. On April 24th, Politico.com published a profile on the website The Intercept entitled How the Intercept is Fueling the Democratic Civil War. Here to discuss that article as well as his new book on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is The Intercept's Washington Bureau Chief Ryan Grimm. Welcome to the show, Ryan.
It's good to be here.
Yeah, thank you. This is a little bit off topic, but this was kind of a burning question I had. Since you were with the Huffington Post with Arianna Huffington as a proprietor, what are the differences between the coverage that you see from HuffPost from her tenure to now that Verizon Wireless owns it?
I think one of the biggest changes has been that the staff has really shrunk. And so their ambitions have had to be very much curtailed. I think the reporters who are there are still, you know, free to do, and the editors there are still free to do the same types of reporting that they were before. It's not that kind of interference. Now, on the other hand, you know, people like me have left, and so, you know, when we left, we took with us, you know, a particular sensibility that hasn't been replaced because, you know, all across digital media, including the one owned by Verizon, you know, budgets are getting slashed badly. And so it's hard to overstate just how much the HuffPost has shrunk. Basically, you know, it started shrinking in probably 2015, but you know, it's probably lost 200 of its 300 people or something. You know, it's a dramatic downturn. And so, you know, a function of that is going to be that it just is able to do less impactful work. You know, Verizon bought Huffington Post by accident. You know, Verizon bought AOL, and AOL because it wanted AOL's advertising business, and AOL happened to own the Huffington Post. It's sort of like you buy a couch and you get the end table with it. And so it's just, the Huffington Post is the end table that's just sitting in the garage, you know, collecting dust. You know, they don't care enough to try to overtly interfere with it. But they also weren't really interested in like getting into the game of progressive digital media. So they're not investing in it. They do layoffs semi-routinely. And then when people leave, just naturally, those people don't get replaced.
What do you make of the Gizmodo layoffs, including one of my favorites, Tim Marchman?
The whole digital media industry is just a hellfire. It never figured out a corporate-based, advertising-based business model to begin with, and that was before Google and Facebook came in and began taking all of the revenue from digital media. Now all of it basically goes to Google and Facebook. So even if they had figured out a model before, that's been kind of taken out from underneath them. They're trying to make money by doing scale on the internet, and you just can't compete when user-generated sites like Facebook or Twitter or whatever else struggle to make money, and they don't pay anybody anything to produce the material, whereas a journalistic site like Gizmodo or the Huffington Post pays a salary and benefits to somebody to create, just basically to create a URL that they can stick advertising on, and that's not going to work. So long term, they're going to have to figure something else out. And I'm at a place that's jointly funded by 90%. I don't know what the percentage is, but bulk funded by one single billionaire, and then by tens of thousands of small donors who are growing by the day. But without the major donor, we wouldn't be able to make it.
Yeah, that was one of the more credible parts of the article in Politico written by Stephen Pelberg. He does bring up the fact that The Intercept is basically funded by eBay founder Pierre Odemeyer. Billionaires do shape the news coverage that we see, maybe to an unprecedented degree at the moment. Does The Intercept have a contingency plan in case the funding from Odemeyer gets withdrawn?
Well, I don't think he's going to withdraw. What was funny about the article is that it took for granted that a news outlet ought to be, ought to be carrying out the vision of the political vision of the person who funds it.
Yeah.
It's interesting. Like, we all kind of assume that, I guess. But it was interesting to just see it kind of put out there so black and white. Hey, wait a minute. This is the person paying for this, yet the work that they're doing seems to be independent of that. That's weird. that can't be sustainable. But I think he is in it for the long haul, and not because he agrees with everything that we write, but because he believes in a mission of doing kind of fearless journalism that confronts power. The contingency plan is what I mentioned, that maybe the last year and a half or so we've been encouraging people to become members and to give to our efforts for tote bags or whatever. And at first we wondered, like, it's widely known by all of our readers that we have this big backer behind us, so who wants to part with their hard-earned $27 to help out a billionaire? But it turned out that our readers very much understood that it's good on principle to have a diverse funding stream and not to be solely reliant on one person. And I think he would agree with that too.
Oh, absolutely.
So readers responded really well to that. So hopefully we can keep growing that. Although, as you've probably seen, there are risks to reader-driven, reader-funded models too, because readers are not always at the vanguard. And sometimes readers are wrong. Let's say that you're running a site that is Move On is actually a good example, but Move On is not media. You know, if Move On wants to kind of lead on the in the progressive space, they might tick off 4 million of their members who support the status quo or support Hillary Clinton or support Kamala Harris or support
or support with Move On supports BDS, for example.
Do they support BDS?
I don't know. I haven't been on MoveOn.com for like 10 years.
Right. So that's like, let's say we wanted to write something about, you know, we had some great investigation into Bernie Sanders and all of our readers hated it. You know, you want to be independent of all types of fears around what the consequences for you personally of your journalism or over the long run, people are going to take those into account and pull their punches.
I mean, that's a scary thing to me is like, if you don't agree with me 100%, you must be against me. Like I've seen that play out. Like I've lost Facebook friends over the fact I didn't want Nancy Pelosi to be speaker again. It seems to me that like, that speaks volumes as far as what our political moment is as much as Trump does.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah. So the piece again was written by Steven Pilberg. He has many moments of disconnect in it. I think the most illustrative example is when he states that since your arrival at The Intercept, the website has, quote, taken a more classic gotcha approach to campaign reporting, end quote, but then interlaced throughout the entire article are links to highly substantial stories about the DCCC putting its thumb on the scales in a congressional race in the 6th District in Colorado, Captain Mark Kelly taking money for speeches at Goldman Sachs. What did you think of the piece? And in fact, are you hard charging?
Yeah, I'm very soft charging. I think that was probably an editing mistake, the gotcha line.
Yeah.
I think what they were getting at was scoop driven, and so if you like you can have something that is both substantive and a scoop, whereas if it's just gotcha, you know, by definition it's really not substantive. So like the DCCC announcing its blacklist, like that was a scoop, and like I think what he meant is that like in the past the Intercept's political coverage had been more analytical, which makes it harder for it to be a central part of the conversation, because if you don't like the analysis, then the center of power can just ignore that analysis. But you can't ignore the news. You know, if we report that the DCCC has a new policy of blacklisting consultants who work with primary challengers, and that's true, you know, you got to pay attention. And so breaking news kind of forces your way into the conversation, whether people want you there or not. So that's kind of what I took from that. Hard charging, I guess. I mean, I don't give up easily. Yeah, I guess that's...
I never knew that you confronted Jesse Walters from the O'Reilly Factor, yeah. But that was you turned that situation on its head. Yes, yeah. That was a hard charging part.
Yeah.
There seems to be a little bit of alcohol involved with that confrontation as well. Or is that correct on that assessment?
I mean, that would be fair to say. This is like 1 a.m. or something at a post White House correspondence dinner party. Embarrassingly, it was at the Institute of Peace. Which I feel kind of some shame over, besmirching the good mission of that institution.
Yeah, well, I guess there was a resolution to,
I got my phone back.
Yeah. You did get your phone back, yeah. Jesse Walters confiscated it. I liked how he didn't like the stalker journalism coming back at him. That was the best part of it.
He was like, if you want to do an interview, let's schedule this later this week. I'm like, what? Do you have no self-awareness at all?
Yeah.
Really?
I think the most establishment Chuck Todian statement, if you will, in the article is as the party grapples with fractures in its coalition, the Intercept is a crowbar working those fractures apart, probing hard at the fault lines at criminal justice reform, Medicare for All, and the Green New Deal, racial justice, and corporate funding. There's so much to unpack in that statement. First, I never knew that it was a journalist's job to keep the, quote, Democratic coalition together and work towards unseating Donald Trump in 2020 because they think that it's part of a strategy to unseat. Your coverage is part of a strategy to unseat Donald Trump in 2020. Second, it seems that the Intercept is a source of the Democratic fracture. What are your thoughts on that whole passage in the piece?
It was funny to see kind of put into print the notion that somebody has a side, that a journalist has a side necessarily.
Yeah.
Like it said, like I think the subtitle said something like, "But are they hurting their own side?" Like which side? Like what side are you talking about? Who, like whose team? You know, what shirt am I supposed to be wearing? Whose team am I on that I didn't know? That was funny to see. But I overall I love the story because I think a lot of people who read it can read right through all that stuff and they see that list of things that we take our crowbar to as. You know, the highest and most worthy pursuits in journalism. You know, what did they say? You know, criminal justice reform, you know, corporate influence, and on and on. So I really appreciated that part of it.
Yeah, and like the other part that was strange was it's just like, oh, you have to be careful around the Intercept because they can just go right through your talking points. It's just like that's kind of what journalism is supposed to be taught about. And
yeah.
About that institutionalized idea that the owner should agree with like the things that you're publishing. It's kind of like it's this weird conditioning on the part of journalism now that the situation at the Las Vegas Review Journal with Sheldon Alderson, mm-hmm. It should be the norm now.
Yeah, and what I hope that our reporting and maybe that story can show to people who are in journalism or getting into journalism is that people's understanding of access is backwards. Like people, like sources don't give you information because they like you or because you treat them well even. Now, if you're a TV anchor and you give softball interviews, you may be more likely to get interviews. That's a separate case than print journalism where people speak to you because you have the goods. You have the audience and they have to speak with you. You have power. And you're using that power to extract from them their attention. And they're going to give that to you whether they like it or not. I remember when I first started covering the Hill, a couple friends from college who worked at different offices, and they didn't give me anything because they didn't have to. They knew that I was going to be their friend regardless. It's the people that had no choice but to share information with me who did so because the alternative was the story was going to get written without their input. And so I would just encourage a lot of people getting into journalism to think about access differently because it's counterintuitive, but the so-called hard charging reporting actually does not have to be in conflict with access. You still get access to these sources because you're writing about them and they have to talk to you. And if they don't, fine.
So even for a show like Meet the Press, which is my form of sadomasochism every Sunday morning?
Well, that one, yeah. Like, you could be, they could be as hard on those politicians as they wanted to. I mean, think about Tim Russert. You know, he was a little more gotcha.
Yeah.
But he was rough. You know, he would take a crowbar, and he would find the wedges, and he would dig into them, and he would embarrass a lot of people. And a lot of people regretted their appearances, and they would happily come on the very next week because, you know, Russert had the power, he had the audience. So you don't have to be sweet to them.
Yeah. About your sources, they did bring up Reality Winner, mm-hmm. The Intercept allegedly, because I don't think it's, I think Glenn Greenwald's sticking to the notion that it wasn't for sure her, but most people have come to the conclusion it was probably her.
Yeah. No, she pled guilty.
Yeah, she pled guilty. What has been the fallout since the Reality Winner basically pleading guilty as your confidential source?
So, I mean, one of the things, and I hope that this has been industry-wide, is to be more clear to people about the risks of anonymous leaking. So, you know, like you hinted at with Glenn, like, we don't even know. We are quite confident that it was her, but she never interacted with us. You know, whoever it was dropped something in the mail to us. And if we had done, you know, there were mistakes were made in the handling of the document along the way. If we had made zero of those mistakes, she still would have been caught, like, absolutely no question, because only six people, I believe it was six people printed that document. And so even if we didn't say that we had a printed copy, they would have checked, well, who printed this? And then they've seen, oh, okay, this person. And then they checked her email, and they knew that she had emailed the podcast, the Intercept podcast, at one point for something unrelated. And then, boom, they'd have started questioning her. Like, they would have immediately narrowed that down. And Edward Snowden, the same way. They were going to figure him out immediately, but he fled and went public. So what sources have to be clear about is that if you are secreting documents out of the NSA, it is mind-bogglingly difficult to do that without them finding out who you are. And so you can take all the protections you want on the back end, but on the front end, you know, they've got that place locked down, and so people need to be extremely careful and weigh the risks, very deliberately. And so, you know, we've modified some of our language around that in our section on, like, you know, how to leak to us and that sort of thing, to be clear that, you know, these are the risks and these are the risks involved here. I mean, she's, from everything I understand, one of the smartest people in the country. She's an absolutely brilliant young woman, and I'm sure that she, you know, was aware of the risk. I'm not saying that she wasn't, but we should be, you know, as clear as we possibly can with people that you know, they're going to come for you, and they're going to come hard.
Yeah, that was the other strange thing about the article is the writer was saying that it pondered to, quote, security paranoids. It's just like, has he read the Snowden reporting that Glenn Greenwald did? It's just like, you should be paranoid, and if you're not paranoid, you're not paying attention.
Right. You know, Washington doesn't, you know, there was a period after those documents were revealed that Washington took surveillance and security seriously, but that has passed. When Washington is back to thinking that consideration of its implications is just, you know, just a playground for the paranoid.
Yeah. So circling back to Medicare for All, the idea is now popular with even Donald Trump supporters now backing it. Mm-hmm. I think the rift that the Intercept is exposing more than anything else is between popular ideas among the populace and the narrow parameters of the debate that moneyed interests pay the Democratic Party to uphold. The best example of this is your reporting on the Nancy Pelosi stating in a private meeting to healthcare insurance companies that they're really not all that serious about Medicare for All.
Right. In fact, that they're against it.
Yeah.
And listed reasons why. And my favorite reason why was that stakeholders are against. Well, yes, of course.
Yeah, of course stakeholders are against this. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, if stakeholders are against as a reason not to do something, then why are you working so hard to get elected every 2 years? I mean, stakeholders can handle themselves. We didn't invent the fissures, and it is in fact the strength of the conflict that is the reason that our coverage is being, you know, paid attention to now. You know, I was covering divides between the left and the center for years at the Huffington Post, and, you know, it's not like nobody read it, but the left was much weaker in the pre-Sanders where it's just basically Elizabeth Warren making viral clips at hearings, and you know, the move-ons and credos and P3Cs of the world, before DSA and Sanders and Jacobin, have elevated a more assertive kind of an organized left. There was you could ignore the conflict between the center and the left because the center was winning it so easily.
Yeah, you were saying that the left was weaker back then. Like, I feel like quiet and angry rage at the fact that another someone that was in ICE detention passed away while in detention, and you know, life goes on as normal. There's no general strikes. There's no one that really that angry. And then meanwhile, we're ongoing. Like, what is it really going to take to mount not just an electoral resistance to what's happening, which is fascism, but like one that is ingrained within our culture?
Probably another economic downturn.
And that wouldn't go the other way. And I mean, that wouldn't go the other way with the right wing militias, like the 3% movement.
It certainly depends. I think, I mean, partly it depends on who's in office at the time. If Republicans are in office at the time, you know, there could be a opportunity to channel some of that to the left. But yeah, you're right. Yeah, we're not headed in a very pretty direction.
No. So the Medicare for All, we were talking about that earlier. One of the promises of the 2008 Obama campaign was card check, which, if listeners aren't familiar with card check, it's basically a way to make union voting more easy to do. That was something that he campaigned on heavily in 2008, and then it quietly disappeared. That seems to be the MO for corporate Democrats.
Yes. That's right. I mean, and so, you know, it's good. It's good to push, the House now to have, to vote and to get on the record on things. But right, we have to be aware that they're much more progressive in the scrimmage than they are, when the game starts. And EFCA is a good example of that. It passed it easily back when they knew Bush was going to veto it. But then the second there was somebody there who was going to sign it, all of a sudden it became much more difficult. And we saw that in Mirror when Republicans repealed Obamacare, 57 times or something?
Yeah.
Safe and comfortable in the knowledge that Obama would rescue them from their worst impulses and veto it. The second they had somebody who wanted to sign it and didn't know that the whole thing was a game and so kept demanding that they pass it, that the Congress, Republican Congress, found that all of a sudden it didn't have the votes anymore.
Yeah, and I think John McCain was a deciding vote on that, right?
Yes and no. I mean, yeah. So he was, but even if he'd have voted yes, all that would have done is sent this skinny repeal bill, so-called, to a conference committee where it would have been blended with this giant garbage House bill. And there was no evidence that there was any common ground that could be reached between the House and the Senate bill that would have satisfied enough people in the Senate to get it through. So yeah, he very wisely put a stake in it right there so that he could go down in history as the one who saved it. But there was no way that even if he voted yet at that point, it was going down. It was just a matter of when.
Okay. The piece in Politico about The Intercept brings up the deep dive that what happened into the ill-fated launch of Matt Taibbi's website as a sign of dysfunction. What do you think a publication's duty is to its readers in terms of internal transparency?
I was proud of that. I mean, I wasn't there at the time, but I thought that was a good thing to do. I think it's fair if the only high impact stuff you're doing is about internal calamities. then that's not going to last long. But they were doing other good work that wasn't necessarily getting enough recognition at the time. I see the point, but like I believe that stories like that are important, and it's great to the more internal you know, transparency, you know, you can have to the outside world, the better.
Yeah, I feel that that project, it feels like one of those things that was never to be. And sadly, because the Matt Taibbi, Alex Preen podcast, the FUBAR Report, that was hysterical. That was one of my favorite podcasts ever. And they had this game where they had Hitler quotes or Tony Robbins, and they couldn't figure out which one was which.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been a fun outlet. It's just a shame that that met its maker.
Yeah. The piece in Politico also gives credit to your reporting for first spotting Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in her primary against Joe Crowley. Before we pivot to the forthcoming book that you're writing about her, I do remember a story about Democrats in New York who were upset with her because she didn't, quote, wait her turn for her district seat. How much of a role in her election do you attribute to The Intercept and that report specifically?
Well, I mean, I'm biased. But, you know, I think it's a really good question. I think a lot of things came together just right for her. You know, the lightning really struck a bunch of different ways in the final couple months of her campaign. You know, her working her tail off to turn in more than 5,000 signatures to get on the ballot was remarkable, and that's the original thing that prevented, you know, or convinced Crowley not to challenge her. And when we saw her turn in 5,000 signatures, knowing that 10 or 11,000 votes might be enough to win, we thought, hey, you know, like let's do this. The luck that the means to, you know, the means of production that who may end up making her viral campaign, these socialist filmmakers, that they noticed her campaign, that they reached out, that they were willing to like lose money to do it, basically, and that they were able to produce a viral ad, which I think came out 2 or 3 days after, you know, it wasn't planned. We had really dragged our feet getting our first story out, but to have our story come out, to introduce her to kind of Washington, the political class, and then to have that viral video come out the next few days, you know, launched her and helped to raise a lot of money. And then, you know, we kept pounding away at Joe Crowley's record and, you know, daily reporting on, you know, what Joe Crowley was doing at fundraisers and, you know, covered it like a real campaign. Move On endorsing, toward the very end was surprising, you know, because as, you know, as we just talked about, like, he was in line to be Speaker of the House, and here's Move On endorsing this bartender who had, you know, very little shot to win. Yet, they did it anyway. Huge risk that they took. So, you know, you had the New York Times weighing in, chiding Crowley for not showing up in the debate. I think that was huge and overlooked, because I think Democratic primary voters, probably 99% of them, read the New York Times, or are influenced by the New York Times. So that mattered. But, you know, they also ran a great campaign, a sophisticated digital operation that blended, you know, door knocking with kind of tracking, you know, who their voters were needed to turn out, and they did it in 12 languages or something like that. So, you know, it was a really truncated election. Like, she was running for more than a year, but she turned her signatures in, I think, in mid-April, and the primary was the end of June. So it really exploded quickly.
Yeah. So we're going to take a brief break. The number to call in is 503-231-8187 if you want to talk to the editor of the Washington Bureau Chief, Ryan Grimm from The Intercept. And we're going to be privying off to his book that he's got that's forthcoming right after this. You are listening to KBOO and the Heather McCoy Show. The number once again is 503-231-8187. Thanks for listening this Thursday morning.
Peace and quiet. I shall have an old age full of rum and riot. I have been a good lad, careful and artistic. I shall have an old age coarse and anarchistic. Once I paid my taxes and followed every rule. Banker, boss, and bureaucrat bought me a willing tool. I voted Democratic and paid the church its due. Now all those swine will have to find some other chump to screw. Credit, insurance, tax, and rent. Of lawyers, agents, generals, and clerics I repent. With this for corporations and scorn for those elected, oh, I will be an old bum, loved but unrespected.
The Heather McCoy Show.
Welcome back to the Heather McCoy Show. My guest is Ryan Grimm. The number again is 503-231-8187. So you have a new book, and it's called We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. I was 4 years old or 5 years old when Jesse Jackson ran for president. Can you describe the political moment? I know Reagan was in office. I know that anti-communism was still very much a thing. And was he treated like a McGovern-type candidate by the establishment Democrats?
I mean, he probably didn't earn, in the beginning, that kind of respect.
Oh, wow.
So he had run in 1984 and got in at the very, very end of the race and did pretty well. Like a couple million votes, a bunch of delegates. It wasn't really a threat. I think he got in January. Which now would be unheard of, but even at that point it was just too late. But he was running more of a symbolic campaign in '84. Despite doing quite well with that symbolic campaign, he wasn't taken very seriously until people looked up, and all of a sudden he was within striking distance of winning it. And interestingly, it was Michigan. Just like in 2016, where Bernie Sanders won his, upset Clinton there, he came into Michigan and upset, Dick Gebhardt, working class union guy who really needed to win there, and beat Michael Dukakis, who was trying to prove that, he could win outside of Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Jackson stomped, and this they were now 37 primaries and caucuses into the season. And he was only like 8 delegates behind Dukakis, polling ahead in the remaining states. And Washington, particularly the Democratic Party, went into a full-blown meltdown. It was total panic. It was bedlam. And they started publicly talking about their plans B, C, D, and E to make sure that Jesse Jackson could not win, walk away with the party nomination. Their final plan was they were going to bring Mario Cuomo, Andrew Cuomo's dad, to the convention if Jesse Jackson had, won the primary but finished with just under 50%. They were going to unite everyone against him and maybe try to peel some of his delegates away. It turned out that he, even though he was leading the polls heading into the final few states, the polls were way off. And I think part of it was a lot of white voters who liked everything Jesse Jackson stood for were like, yes, I'll vote for the black guy, but not if he's going to win. You know, you didn't tell me he might win. And so it was sort of a, you know, these are Democrats, these are progressives, liberals, you know, quote unquote. And so it was Wisconsin where, you know, that was the key blow to him. But what, you know, he managed to register several million new voters, and he pulled together a coalition of blacks, Hispanics, progressive whites, Native Americans. He was, you know, strongly for LGBT rights. You know, it basically looks like Bernie Sanders' platform today.
Yeah.
And his vision for the future of the party was that this is the coalition, that this is a majority if you will it to be one, and if you give people a reason to make it a majority. And there was actually a huge farm crisis going on at the time, and he got a stunning amount of support from farmers and from agricultural areas, because they recognized that he was kind of taking on the banks and taking on, you know, what FDR called the malefactors of great wealth. Like they understood themselves to be in a class fight, and to be on the wrong end of it, and that Jesse Jackson was on their side.
And that was a time of Willie Nelson's like Farm Aid, right?
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And you know, and you had some, you know, the dominant politics at the time are probably, you know, best defined by the, you know, the We Are the World video. You know, loosey goosey stuff while the new right is kind of, you know, ripping the world apart. But Jesse Jackson was trying to pull together like a genuine opposition to that believed in something.
So how did Mondale end up getting the nomination?
So Mondale was 84, and he was just kind of a next in line guy. He was Jimmy Carter's vice president. He had all of the backing of organized labor and the kind of remnants, what was left of like the New Deal coalition. And so he basically locked that up very early in 84. 88, Dukakis beat Jackson in Wisconsin, and then kind of cruised from there to the nomination. And what, you know, we look back and we think that, well, these things are, you know, preordained. It was 1988, of course Republicans are going to win, but actually everyone at the time thought that the White House was Democrats for the taking. Reagan had, you know, with his dementia, stumbled out of office only avoiding impeachment because he was kind of running out of time. The Iran-Contra scandal led to a huge Democratic wave in 1986, and that's why so many people were running in 88, because they thought they were going to win the White House. And George W. H. W. Bush was not remotely seen as an impressive candidate. This complete patrician, you know, he's an aristocrat. Remember, he didn't know what the price of milk was, and didn't, you know, was shocked by the grocery store scanners. And Dukakis was beating him by like 17 points coming out of the convention. And it goes back to the electability argument that we're having now about Joe Biden. Democratic voters fancy themselves not just pundits but good pundits, yet their predictions about who's electable and who's not electable are almost always wrong.
Yeah.
So the same crew that told us that Michael Dukakis was the one that was going to be electable, you know, is now saying that Joe Biden, like John Kerry, is the one who's going to be electable. And so Dukakis managed to lose to this deeply unpopular vice president, H.W. Bush, and lead to 4 more years. And then Clinton very deliberately in 92 took on Jesse Jackson, like that sister soldier moment that everybody knows about.
Yeah.
That was at the Rainbow Coalition conference, Jesse Jackson's conference, with Jesse Jackson on stage. And Jesse, you know, I think Jesse's movement was the target, that Clinton was here to say, like, I'm the party now. And so I think we misunderstand a bit of his intention with that moment,
yeah,
which I go over in the book, actually.
One thing I want to mention before we go to Jack, who is on hold, is that you mentioned that Jesse Jackson got on the campaign trail late. One of the things that I kind of find frustration in with our election season is it goes on far too long. I think Roosevelt one year, it might be 34. I don't remember. I can't pin it down in my head exactly. But basically, the campaign season was 3 months. The American people decided, yeah, another 4 years of Roosevelt's a good idea. I think we can hammer out our issues in about 2 months. And then you have that whole campaign apparatus, which has trade magazines, which has consultants, which has mailers. I think there's too much professional apparatus around the campaign structure. And I think progressives need to like start saying, no, campaigns take away from really important grassroots organizing. We need to limit this down to maybe 3 months of a race at most.
Yeah. Right. If you're always just campaigning for president, you're never governing. You're never organizing around, you know, what the government ought to actually do. It's true. I mean, Elizabeth Warren this year announced in December of 2018, I think, which is one of the earliest. Well, what's his name? The Goldman Sachs or whatever bank he worked for, John Delaney, has been in for several years now.
Yeah.
Nobody seems to know he's running, though.
I didn't know he was running. I knew the guy from
Congressman.
Yeah, I knew the guy from Starbucks was running, but I didn't know any.
No. Nope.
Yeah, wow.
John Delaney, running as a Democrat. He bought himself a House seat a couple years ago. Gave it up, and somebody else bought it. Another billionaire bought it.
Oh, wow.
And now Delaney's running.
One of my favorite Howard Schultz stories is when he owned the Seattle Supersonics and the Seattle Storm. The Storm won a championship, and then he gave the players like a $10 gift card to Starbucks. Like, he's just tone deaf, and he's just keeps on trucking.
Yep.
Yeah. So Jack is on hold. Welcome to the Heather McCoy Show.
Yeah, thanks for bringing in somebody from the inside of The Intercept. It gives an opportunity to ask what the world's happening with that whole trove of Snowden documents. You know, I'm sure you're aware from certain factions that are asking, where are they? Why aren't they coming out? What's going on? And I'll just take the answer off the air. Thanks.
Thank you for calling.
Sure thing. So the Snowden archives are, you know, in the possession of a number of different news outlets, the New York Times, The Guardian, The Intercept, I believe a few others around, the Washington Post, of course, some others around the globe. And all of those stopped kind of publishing on those documents several years ago, you know, more than several years ago, whereas The Intercept had continued to do so, and had done so at significant expense, you know, with an archivist and a significant amount of security, you know, around the archives so that it could be done responsibly. And a couple of things were going on. You know, by this point, these are documents that belong in the hands of academic researchers because they are their history. You know, anything that is late 2000s to today, or what's contained in it has been very much picked over and has been published. We've published thousands and thousands of them, of those documents. So at some point you're getting into you're getting out of the realm of news and into the realm of history, and so we've been pursuing the right partner, the right academic partner who would take that on. But what we did is we just recognized that as a kind of as a news generating activity, it just wasn't really there anymore. Glenn, of course, presumably still has the archive. Laura Poitras, who got it originally, she still has the archive. Like, it's not as if the archive is disappeared. There are many copies of it around at different news outlets. And, you know, there is absolutely nothing stopping the New York Times, the Washington Post, or the Guardian, or anybody else from going back through it and continuing to report on the documents. But you know, long ago, they made the same call that we're making now, which is that this is now something that needs to be gone over by historians and other academics, so that the public can get a full look at all of this in a responsible way.
Yeah. That was a good question, Jack. Thanks for calling. Going back to your book about the Rainbow Push Coalition to AOC, one of the through lines in that timeline is 1992. And in 1992, a mockumentary of significant importance came out called Bob Roberts, where Tim Robbins plays Bob Roberts, who's a folk singing fascist musician who's kind of like the anti-Bob Dylan, and Gore Vidal plays Senator Brinkley Paste. And what's interesting is it seems like the politics of Senator Brinkley Paste are on the amend, where they're on the incline. And in that film, Gore Vidal plays a very tired senator who's been running up against the same moneyed interests for a very long time against a young competitor who has very dark ties, and I think Alan Rickman was his kind of Karl Rovian character in that film. What do you think of the moment that Bob Roberts was made in, and what does it say about our time still?
Yeah, there was a shift in the late 1970s, early 1980s, as the Republican Party, really kind of coalesced around far right wing. And white identity politics, which they had been struggling to form for decades, but they had been kind of resisted in some ways by both ends of the faction, the white supremacist Democrats in the South didn't like the kind of Rockefeller liberal Republicans in the North. The Democrats in the South were kind of racist and populist. Whereas the Republicans in the North were not explicitly racist, and they were kind of royalist. And so we see the coalition now as almost preordained and natural. But at the time it wasn't obvious that those folks would get together, and they really did use kind of race. And I had several chapters on this that ended up not making into the book. But they used race as the central point to organize around, but the Northern Royalist Republicans didn't want to be explicit racists, and so they both organized their politics around the strength of the federal government. The Royalists wanted a weaker federal government so that their businesses could expand and could form monopolies, and that their tax rates could go down, and all the other benefits that come to the private, to the top of the private sector from the shrinking government, less powerful government. And the South wanted less federal government for obvious reasons, so that they could continue with their Jim Crow policies. And so they finally organized around that principle, and that helped them, put the coalition together that was able to be, led into Congress by Newt Gingrich in 78, and then into the White House by Ronald Reagan in 1980, which is all kind of fairly well known. But what my book gets into is the Democratic reaction to that. There were kind of two choices at that point. You could go the Jesse Jackson route, which says, look, we have a majority. Let's stand for something. Let's register everybody, and let's beat these people back. And the other says, well, we actually still control the House of Representatives. Democrats do. And we're getting outraised, and so as long as we add a corporate fundraising component to our politics and maintain control of the House, we'll win the White House every now and then, and we don't really have to think about kind of recreating a new coalition or reshaping the party to respond to this moment. And they went with the latter strategy, which eventually. The same year that Bob Roberts came out, and so gave us Bill Clinton, but it wasn't you know, and it eventually gave us Donald Trump.
Yeah. And then what role, Reagan fired the air traffic controllers before your timeline in your book picks up. What affected union partnership with Democratic candidates in that lessened effect, because you have declining union membership in the 90s. And then you have the DNC, as they were called. I think they've now morphed into DCCC. What effect did that have, like trying to like basically push out anyone that wasn't a corporate Democrat at that time?
Yeah, I think if unions could go back in time and redo it, they would be a lot more tactical about it than they were. You know, in 1976, they were split. And I do get into some of the history just to kind of set the stage for Jesse Jackson. But they were all over the place. Some unions got behind George Wallace, who ran, you know, white supremacists. A lot of them got behind Scoop Jackson, who was this far lefty on domestic policy, and he was also basically the godfather of the neoconservative movement. Like Dick Cheney and the like revere Scoop Jackson, who ran for president in 76, with a lot of union support. And Carter really had very little union support, coming from the South, and he had very little name recognition, and he just kind of came out of nowhere, very Buttigieg like in some ways. And
well, Hunter S. Thompson helped him out a lot too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's right. I have that in the book. He kind of limped away with the nomination, and he was hostile to organized labor. He pushed deregulation just as hard as Reagan did it before him. Labor had some major priorities. They were pushing for card check and a bunch of other labor reform that would have maybe, you know, not staved off their decline, but definitely slowed it for and strengthened them greatly. And they fell one vote short in the Senate, I believe. And Carter didn't lift a finger. You know, Carter had no interest in helping labor. And there's some quotes from Carter's top officials saying that the UAW makes too much. They want the UAW to suffer. At the same time, the labor unions were not, were not working with the left. They didn't see an ally in any of the more progressive candidates who were running. When if they had, and had a little more vision, they might have, the left and labor might have both been better off. And so, by the 80s, they're really starting to get rattled.
My guest has been Ryan Grimm. He is the editor of the Washington bureau chief of The Intercept. I had a caller on the line. I'm somewhat dyslexic and I was not watching the computer screen, so I do apologize. Susanna, I apologize to Susanna for not seeing that. Ryan Grimm's new book out is We've Got People, From Jesse Jackson to AOC, The End of Big Money and the Rise of a Movement. When your book comes out, when is the date, and would you want to come back on the show?
Yeah, May 28th. I would be happy to come back.
Cool. Okay, so May 28th. This is the Heather McCoy Show. Thanks for joining us, Ryan. And coming up, I think, is the book talk. We'll see you next week. This is the Heather McCoy Show, and this is KBOO Portland.
The KBOO Development Committee meets the first Wednesday of each month at 4:30 p.m. and is looking for new members. Work on the committee includes evaluating and implementing fundraising and outreach strategies, developing and strengthening partnerships and collaborations, and advocating for KBOO in the community. If you are interested in joining the committee, contact Development Director Allison Kolb at allison@kboo.org to learn more. Meetings are held at KBOO, located at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Please call the station at 503-231-8032 prior to the meeting to confirm that it is being held. This is KBOO Portland. The time now is 11 o'clock. Coming up next on Between the Covers, host Ken Jones talks with Meg Vogt, author of the new book of photographs and poems, MYKU, My Portland. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk talks to Portland-born author Mitchell S. Jackson about his book, Survival Math. KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information is available on Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
Blue skies smiling at me, nothing but blue skies do I see.
Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones.